It's time for Forward Nation Radio. Now here he is, the host of Forward Nation Radio, David Leventhal.
Ooh, we're on. Hi, welcome to Forward Nation Radio with me, David Leventhal. I'm sorry, I was just enjoying a bit of executive time. You know, we've had a lot of negative things to say about the President of the United States, but finally this week I've had some reason to feel a fraternity with him, to empathize with the President of the United States, because it turns out we have kind of a similar hard-working schedule. When I saw this week about the typical Donald Trump day, as outlined in Axios and other places, I said, wow, that reminds me of how hard we, and by we I mean me, work at Forward Nation Radio. That's right, starting the day up at the crack of 11 a.m. to show up at work, ready to dig in and meet with, in the case of Trump, his chief of staff, in my case, my chief of staff, Damien, and producer Damien Hardeen. So we meet, we chat for a little while, and then it's time for some executive time. About an hour of executive time, which we call watching TV, coffee. Tweeting, coffee. No, the coffee I think is during the meeting time. that's real time. Phone. We've got a new term here for the executive time. For goofing off. Well, we don't goof off. But after an hour of heavy-duty executive time, we're kind of worn out. And since it's so late in the day, it's time for an hour's worth of lunch, as it is with the President of the United States. After an hour's worth of lunch, well, one does have to digest one's food, so it's another hour and a quarter of executive time. Yes, term will undoubtedly just take great hold in our country. Already, my six-year-old boy comes home from school and says, can I have some executive time? I didn't finish watching that Power Rangers DVD we took out the other day. And I say, no executive time for you now. Daddy's busy. So after another hour and a quarter of executive time, well, it's back to hard work, where I have, like the president, another 45-minute meeting or so with somebody on the staff. Then, knocked out after a 45-minute meeting, 15 more minutes of executive time, or time to let my brain wind down. Then I probably have another meeting with somebody, whoever's on the top of the meeting list that day. And at that point, thank God, it's already about 4:15 and time to call it a day. Some days, we at Forward Nation Radio don't even get to call it a day at 4:15, unlike the president. We live stream at 5. I need a raise, or a salary, or anything. Yes, sirree, tough day for the president. Or, as Sarah the Huckster describes him, the president is one of the hardest workers I've ever seen. Oh, Sarah the Huckster. It's always wonderful to listen to your dulcet tones. But to be born privileged like that. Previous hardest workers that Sarah the Huckster has ever seen apparently include the person she knows who ordered lunch at the salad bar and actually had to get his own lunch. Also, one of the hardest workers she's ever seen. Yes, it's tough to grow up with a silver spoon in your mouth. I know. We can't take anything that Sarah Huckster says seriously. Just because she says the president is a hard worker almost certainly means the opposite. But at least if she's going to lie to us all the time, it's nice to have some fun with it every now and again. Okay, we're having fun with this, but obviously the president of the United States needs his relaxation time, his downtime, his pulling it together time, his being a very stable genius time. because, as Donald Trump tells us, he is a very stable genius, and it probably takes quite a while to get that stability charged. Stable genius. Stable genius. For some reason, those words have been ringing a bell.
I like the way that rolls out.
Stable genius.
Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
That's it. That's why the words ring a bell. President Wile E. Coyote. Well, we always knew he was Looney Tunes. Now, apparently, he's actually Looney Tunes. Wait. Can't be President Wile E. Coyote. Donald Trump doesn't have the record of success that Wile E. Coyote has compiled over the years. Donald Trump, of course, had to point out what a very stable genius he is because of the new book that came out. We briefly referenced last week because it was hot off the presses when we went to air last week. The Michael Wolff book, I believe entitled Harry Potter and the Fucking Moron President? No? Harry Potter and the President Who Must Not Be Named? The Half-Wit Prince. Good one. Harry Potter. Maybe that's it. It doesn't have Harry Potter in the title. It's apparently captured the attention like the eighth Harry Potter book would have. So you can understand my mistake in thinking that it had to have Harry Potter in the title. I sort of don't understand why this book has captured the attention of the zeitgeist the way it has. After all, there's not really anything particularly new in it. For the two-thirds of the thinking country that actually gets real news, we knew the president was a moron, and we knew that he was mentally unbalanced. I guess, yes, it's nice to know that pretty much everybody who works for him feels the same way. Before then, we only had knowledge of a few people who worked for him calling him a fucking moron or an idiot or some version of that. Now, apparently, we know it's basically everybody. Of course, to the one-third people who still support Donald Trump, it's more fake news and clatter that's not going to have any impact on them anyway. The book has had some impact, of course. Steve Bannon, one of the principal sources in the book, guy who indicated treason might have occurred at the Russia meeting and didn't have some very nice things to say about, among other things, Donald Jr., Ivanka, Jared. He is out as the head of Breitbart Fake News. That's right, it turns out that Steve Bannon has done the unthinkable, has angered the billionaire Mercers who back Breitbart and its bullshit, because Steve Bannon engaged in the one cardinal sin of the right-wing media universe. He accidentally told the truth. Not only that, but he told the truth that might perhaps somehow have an impact on the Mercers' ability to lie to the people who listen to them so that they can continue to take their money. So Bannon is out as the head of Breitbart. I hope they could find somebody to replace him. This makes me remember, of course, the war on Obama waged by Donald Trump and much of the right-wing media while he was president, accusing Obama of not working hard enough. One of the hardest working presidents we've ever had. If he went out and played golf one day, Trump was all over him. Once again, I bring this up not to discuss the hypocrisy, because hypocrisy of Donald Trump and the right isn't news anymore. They're not hypocrites, they're just full of shit all the time. What's really interesting about this story is how in the case of Trump, nobody really cares. With Obama, you wanted him working. With Trump, we're all better off if he's not anywhere near the White House. Again, one of the interesting revelations from the book is how so many people in the Trump administration, people who work for Trump, justify their being there by saying they are protecting the United States from the President of the United States. They need to protect us from the President. These are the offensive line protecting the nuclear football. Because of this and other revelations coming out, the war on reason has to work overtime. And we will be seeing, as we always do, an even greater attack on reason. Well, the war on reason, of course, is handmade to the war on democracy, both of which we continue to discuss on this show. The war on democracy has made the news several times this week. Start with a moment of silence for the Election Integrity Commission. That's right. Do you remember the Election Integrity Commission? Where they were going to show how voting fraud is the only thing that kept Donald Trump from actually winning the popular vote for president? How it prevents Republicans from owning everything in this country through voting rather than through fraud? Well, it has quietly gone away with a record of success that it leaves behind. Apparently, a couple of old white guys who voted twice for Trump. Other than that, no evidence of voter fraud. Well, that won't stop Kris Kobach from going back to Kansas and lying to old ladies so that he and his friends can steal from them. It was big news when they put together this commission to go after fraudulent voting. It's less big news when the commission disbands the nominee. This is Republican tactic. This motivates how lies on the right work. The lie is big news. When the lie gets refuted, it's old news. So just keep lying. The war on democracy was also in the news this week through gerrymandering. We've talked at length about the last seat contested in the Virginia House of Delegates. A couple weeks ago, it looked like the Democrat had won to put the chamber into a tie. Well, it turns out one vote was counted, as we talked about last week, and that made it a tie, and the tie was broken by a coin flip. Now, as awful as that might sound to our viewers, understand that in America, the coin flip has a much better voting record than the average American voter. But in this case, the coin flip didn't end well. And the Republican got the seat based on the coin flip, keeping the House of Delegates in a Republican majority. Okay, I understand it's hard to figure out how these things are going to be decided, but in this case, the Virginia House of Delegates, Democrats had received more than 200,000 votes more than Republicans. Is it possible that maybe some court or somebody in Virginia could say, when we have a contested seat, maybe the party that's in the minority, despite winning 200,000 more votes statewide, should actually get that seat on the basis of their statewide performance? Nah, sounds ridiculous. Although less ridiculous with the new ruling in North Carolina on gerrymandering. A federal appeals court ruling saying that the partisan gerrymandering that Republicans engaged in North Carolina in order to keep a large majority in a House, in House seats in a state that is basically evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans violated the Constitution. A ruling that will soon be eclipsed by the Supreme Court when it gets around to Gil v. Whitford. But it was interesting how aggressive, how angry, assertive the majority ruling was in this case, coming out and saying this is about democracy and one political party stealing an advantage through electoral fraud and districting is not something that can be tolerated in America. Are you listening, Anthony Kennedy, the one conservative in the United States Supreme Court, who may not quite have phoned in his vote during his confirmation hearings? Also, the federal courts, speaking of democracy, ruled this week that the administration's actions on DACA recipients were unconstitutional and stayed the ruling, requiring our government to extend DACA to those who have already qualified. Yes, this is also something that will be seen, that we will be addressing again later. We have talked at length about DACA and the importance of giving these undocumented a path to citizenship in America. The Republican reaction to this, of course, was just shows you can't trust the courts on anything. So what does this mean? Republicans better go back real quickly to stocking our federal courts with people who won't apply the law, but will apply their rigid ideology. And that's what we're up against. Democrats better take back the Senate in 2018. More democracy on the fact that the United States government has announced that it will be opening up nearly all offshore oil, offshore areas to oil drilling. Well, not necessarily those areas ruled by Republicans. Florida just got a pass because the governor of Florida was not real happy about this one. So once again, it's red states versus blue states. Screw the blue states. We're going to allow all your oil drilling off your coasts, even though you don't want it. This is something about federalism, which we will talk about again later, as we have in the past in this show. So much for states' rights and states being able to protect their own citizens. But also, this is a reflection of the influence of big corporate donors in the Trump White House and the Republicans in every aspect of our government. Turns out, Murray Energy, run by Robert Bob Murray, a big Trump contributor, wrote up a wish list for the administration of what they wanted. And almost everything on that wish list was met. Including on that wish list, ending regulations on greenhouse gases. Ending regulations on mine safety. Cutting the EPA staff more than 50%. Ending, limiting mine safety enforced by our regulatory agencies. Yes, this is what it means to drain the swamp. And now we discuss the latest news on Russia. We'll go back to Russia next week. We're not going to spend a lot of time this week because of our special guest we'll be introducing in a couple of minutes. But the big news now is that Senator Dianne Feinstein released, without the approval of Republicans on the Senate committee, the full transcript of the testimony of Glenn Simpson, one of the founders of Fusion GPS, the group that put together the Steele dossier, and it reported on Trump ties with Russia and possible collusion. This apparently is basically unprecedented, that a minority member of the committee would release the full transcript without the agreement of the majority. Oh, those terrible Democrats. Why is this relevant? Well, we'll talk next time about the collusion and the obstruction of justice that it continues to evidence. But here it evidences the divide in this country, in our Senate and in our politics. That the Republicans and the Democrats can't agree on anything. While the Republicans are busy in the Senate and the House covering up Trump administration collusion with Russia, Democrats are saying maybe we should actually do something about this. Republicans on the committee have been selectively leaking portions of that testimony to try to discredit the report. Rather than investigating possible collusion with a foreign rival, they are busy trying to cover it up. And finally, a Democrat on the committee took the bold step of saying enough. Maybe this is a sign that Democrats will rise out of their stupor and start fighting back the way the Republicans have always fought, a little bit dirty. Maybe this means that the Democrats are going to start playing hardball and not let the Republicans constantly spread fake news that is not adequately responded to on the other side. Should this information have been released? Of course it should have. But that issue, of course, isn't even being discussed. It's just going outside of protocol. But of course, it was going outside of protocol that the Republicans were leaking information selectively. It was going outside of protocol that the Republicans did not let the Democrats know that they were going to issue an indictment to go after or an information on Christopher Steele, the author of most of the dossier. This is fighting fire with fire. And this is where we are as a country, basically ungovernable. And this is why the need for journalism is greater now than it's ever been. And that leads us to our special guest. We are excited to welcome to the show Brandon Jordan. Brandon is a freelance reporter based in Queens. He's a contributing writer to Queens County Politics. His work has appeared in The Nation magazine, City Limits, Waging Nonviolence, and more, a lot more. Brandon has, for a young man, a long history of actual journalism, uncovering stories. So, Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for bringing me along.
That leads me, obviously, your long history of journalism leads me to ask, what's it like in the belly of the fake news beast?
I'm hanging in there, let's just say that. It's been, the past year with Trump has been just a transformation of what journalism has become today. A lot more aggressive reporting, a lot more investigative reporting.
Do you think that journalism has generally done well with the Trump administration?
So far, I would say so, because there's been a lot more teeth in terms of coverage of Trump. So it's having an impact on a lot of these representatives, a lot of these people who we have to check in power, because that's our job as journalists, watchdogs, not lapdogs.
Is that, so why do you think that journalism has done so well, that there's sort of been this renaissance? Do you think it's because of what you just indicated, that the need is greater than it's been?
Absolutely. After the election of Trump, for example, a lot of publications, New York Times, Washington Post, saw a dramatic rise in subscriptions. That reflected a need among a lot of consumers who wanted to read the news, because they understood that under the Trump administration, things are going to be a lot different from the previous administration. So you definitely see that need, and you definitely see a lot of reporters responding to that need.
Tell us a little bit about your experiences getting into journalism, and how anyone watching who's similarly motivated to bring out real news to make this a better country or a better world could get involved in journalism.
Sure. What I found really fascinating about journalism is that I'm able to talk to a lot of people across not just the United States, but also across the world, and learn about their ideas of resistance, their ideas of what politics and power is in their backyards. So I've spoken with people in Washington State, in Ohio, all the way far out in Australia, in Argentina, here in New York, and that's what fascinates me the most about working in this industry for years. I love talking to people, but I love writing about what people are doing, how they're organizing, how they're working with each other. But that's what I find important as a journalist, that you have a community and you're reporting on things that really matter at the end of the day.
Okay. Tell us about a recent story, something that we should know about.
Yeah, so yesterday I published on Waging Nonviolence, a story about activists in Washington State, and they launched a climate countdown. So for the 60-day session this year, they are going to be pressuring Democrats to act immediately on climate change. They were there yesterday in front of the Olympia State Capitol building, and they're going to be there every single day telling them, you do this now, because there's no excuse whatsoever to not work on climate change. And that was fascinating, because I spoke with a lot of activists who told me, this is the right opportunity. You only have a few years left. We don't have 10, 20, 25 years. We only have 3 years at most to make sure we get climate change under 1.5 degrees Celsius. If not, you've seen it last year, the hurricanes, everything, the wildfires, that's going to be our future, but even worse.
How much we had spoken briefly before, the Democrats have now control every aspect of the Washington state government. This is
yes.
A new phenomenon. And that's why these requests are being made, to basically make sure that how did you put it before, that the actions finally match the rhetoric from the Democratic Party?
Yes, that the rhetoric that they have matches the actions that they're going to be doing. There's no more excuse. GOP was in control from 2013 up until last year of the state Senate. Now that's not true anymore. Democrats have control of state Senate, state House, and governorship. There's no excuse. That's what these activists are saying. do it now. This is the only time this year that they can probably make sure it's done.
And how much can they actually accomplish just in Washington State, especially in light of, as we talked about briefly a few minutes before, the Trump administration just announced that they're going to be ending the Obama-era ban on offshore oil leases.
While they don't have the same powers as the federal government in terms of interstate relations, what they can do is two things that the activists have demanded. One, 100% renewable energy powered all government sectors by 2028. Two, to pass a climate test, essentially guidelines that say anything that affects the climate in a very harmful way will be rejected. That means any fossil fuel project or proposal will be rejected. It will not be accepted if this climate test is enacted into law. So those are two examples of what the government can do, and that could possibly be used as a model for other states around the country. Oregon, California, Idaho, New York, Florida, you name it. If Washington State can do it, they can do it too.
It sounds like that's really what a lot of this is about. That this is a model for the future of the Democratic Party, assuming that it regains power nationally in a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it might be. That the battle between the Clinton Democrats, the go slowly and don't get industry angry at you, more conservative Democrats, and the more activist wing of the party, this is to push the party in a more activist direction.
Absolutely. It's what's needed today. Naomi Klein wrote that book about climate change and how capitalism is all tied to that. We need to focus on making sure we have systemic change, or else we're going to have more Trump-like figures in power making sure that our lives enter a neoliberal, corporate, shallow life that just ruins everything on this planet. I mean, we can't have that, and that's what these people are trying to do. They're trying to say, no more. We're not going to go back to how it was in the 80s and 90s. We're going to change our future.
Well, I know one thing that's for sure, which is in order for the Democratic Party, if it chooses to go that route, promote the interests of the American public and the world, it's going to take a lot of honest journalism to make sure that the American public is aware of what's going on, because there is going to be a lot of dishonest journalism from the Koch brothers, from the Mercers, from the oil and gas industry, to try to make sure that Democrats are punished from that, which I think is a reason why the Democratic Party has been so slow to move for all these years. It's going to take a lot of journalism, and we hope you're at the forefront. We hope you will come back. We thank you for being here today. We'll see you soon back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck in your journalism. Finally, a few last words on our show about another topic that's been in the news and I'm sure you're all wondering if we were going to discuss. That's right. Most of our law enforcement mechanism in our government is being told not to concern itself with a hostile foreign power's efforts to obstruct a U.S. election. Being told not to concern itself with a president of the United States who might be compromised by that foreign power. It's being told not to worry so much about protecting the air, the water of its citizens, the health of its citizens. But we have found something that our law enforcement agencies, that our Justice Department, run by the garden gnome, can finally sink its teeth into. And that is pot. That's right. We are going to go after those states that have decided to legalize marijuana because that's what their citizens want and because the war against marijuana has been an abject failure. So this is what apparently is meant to be occupying the time of the United States Justice Department, thanks to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the garden gnome. We've talked at length on this show about the concept of states' rights, referred to it briefly earlier in this show. This is what Republicans are always throwing out there for consumption when they're saying, let bigots be bigots, and let's not tell the federal government that racists don't get to act upon their racism. that's always trotted out by Republicans when it comes to, let's make sure that the federal government, which is often the only entity with the ability to promote the interests of the citizens of the United States, let's make sure it does not act to protect the health of its citizens. Because that's for the states to do. And the fact that the states can't do it in most cases because corporations put them into this intergovernmental bidding war, that doesn't matter. We believe in states' rights, the rights of the states. We've talked many times on the show about how much bullshit that is. Well, here is a great example of how much the so-called states' rights advocates really believe in the rights of states as opposed to the rights of bigots and the rights of corporations to destroy the planet at great profit. Many of us believe that it is up to the citizens of a state to decide whether or not those citizens get to enjoy either medical or even recreational use of marijuana. A state's rights advocate would clearly say if people in California want to smoke pot, they should be able to smoke pot. But our so-called state's rights advocates in the federal government are now saying that they're going to arrest anybody or could arrest anybody under federal law involved in the trade. Once again, making it clear the lie about states' rights. An empty slogan. What about their calls for personal freedom? That's a big one. We've talked at length on this show about how words are misused to mislead people. And the word in America that is misused more than any other, probably, is freedom. Well, where are the freedom advocates now? If someone in California wants to grow pot in his greenhouse and smoke it on occasion, who are we to say no? Why would the Justice Department even give a crap about this, taking on many of the Trump supporters? Well, it comes down to another oftentimes topic on this show, the impact of money on our government. Pharmaceutical companies don't like medicinal marijuana. They don't like recreational marijuana. Why? In many cases, it helps people much better than the products that pharmaceutical companies want to sell them for a lot of money help people, and with fewer side effects. So the pharmaceutical companies are behind the efforts to undermine attempts to legalize marijuana. And now, they have a willing listener in the White House. I'll end with a brief story from my own life. I have an elderly friend who unfortunately has been suffering for several years through some terrible health problems. I saw her fairly recently, and we were engaged in a conversation, and I asked, "How are you doing?" And I was really happy to hear, "I'm doing great." The first time I've heard that from her in many, many years. I said, "Really?" She says, "I'm doing great. I'm on medical marijuana. And it has completely changed her life. Much better than the shit the pharmaceutical companies were selling her all those years." I guess this is part of draining the swamp. Anyway, that's today's show. As always, thank you for joining us. Like Looking Forward, go to forwardnationradio.com. That's forwardnationradio.com and get the full experience. You'll see the video from this and every episode there and on our YouTube channel as well. Don't miss the next Forward Nation Radio podcast on Podbean at podbean.com. If you like what you heard, like us on Facebook, subscribe to our YouTube channel, send our links to your friends. Spread the word. Forward Nation Radio. See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward Nation Radio with David Leventhal.